Okay, so my name is Coco Wilder, and I'm here interviewing Dr. E. Patrick Johnson. It is February 26th, 2014, and we are at the Love House in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So first, I just want to say thank you for agreeing to sit down with me.
No problem.
Of course. First, could you just tell me about your childhood?
Mm-hmm. I was born in Hickory, North Carolina. On March 1st, 1967, and I was the youngest of seven children. My mother was a single parent, and she raised all of us by herself. We first lived in a small town, section of town called Ridgeview, and Ridgeview was known as basically the black side of town, because Hickory is divided, and still to this day, by a set of railroad tracks that divides the north side of town and the south side of town. And the south side of town is where most of the black people lived, and Ridgeview was in the southwest corner or quadrant of Hickory. Hickory has many distinctions, but one of the distinctions is the city geographically is divided up into quadrants, like Washington, D.C. And so it's northeast, northeast, northwest, north, and southeast, southwest. And southeast and southwest were mainly where the black people live, and the majority of them in southwest Hickory. So I grew up on 8th Avenue Drive, southwest. Was a very popular street because 8th Avenue Drive, at the beginning of it, it was where the Ridgeview Library and a community center and swimming pool was. And on the other end of it was the cemetery, the Ridgeview Cemetery, which was a black-only cemetery. And so I was born there, on 8th Avenue Drive, and there were eight of us living in a one-bedroom apartment. My mother was a domestic worker, and, I used to go with her to work, at the Olson's house, which was a very rich white family that lived on the north side of town, on the north side of the tracks. And I would go with my mother to work, to clean their home. And then when I was, I think I was 8 or 9, we moved to public housing. And for us, that was a really big deal because we had 4 bedrooms. But because I'm the youngest of seven, and there's a big age gap between my older siblings and me, by the time we moved to public housing, there were only 4 of us, 4 of the kids. So my mother had a room, brother Adrian had a room, and my brother Gregory and I shared a room, and my brother Tommy had a room. But then my brother Tommy moved out, he went to the Navy, and my brother Adrian moved out, and then my sister moved in with her daughter, but I got my own room. So, but my childhood was filled with a lot of joy. I was a very introverted child. Not many people would believe that about me because I perform now, but as a child I was really shy, but I loved to sing. I always loved to sing and dance and act, and my mother would put me in talent shows, and I would get stage fright and run off stage. We were poor, but I didn't know we were poor. I didn't ever have to want for anything, and it was a very close-knit community. We lived in the one-bedroom apartment, like I said, that was it was two apartments attached to each other. So we and for a while, my Aunt Mary Lee lived right beside of us. But there was a driveway that divided where we lived and these other apartments called the Embassy Apartments. And there were five of those. There were cinder block apartments, and they had two bedrooms in them. But there could be families of six or seven living in those two bedroom apartments. And everybody watched out for each other. There were lots of kids in the neighborhood, and you know, if you got in trouble with someone else's parents, you know, you got another spanking when you got back home. So it was a really close knit community. We did a lot of eating together, sharing food. So I remember I was a very happy child, and loved playing outside. That was all, you know, just before computers. So, you know, no texting or computer games or things like that. So we were outside. We used to catch and torture bees. We used to make mud pies. We would make hot rods. So we'd go find abandoned houses and scavenge them for chairs, like kitchen table chairs, that we would then use as a seat on our hot rod that we made out of a big plank, a wood plank that we'd find. We'd take we'd go to the junkyard and find old wheels from wheelbarrows, and those would be the wheels on our hot rod. And you know, we would spend all day building that hot rod, and then it would maybe make one trip down the street before it fell apart. But I really enjoyed doing stuff like that, and making mud pies and making blueberry pies. And our blueberry pies were, we picked blueberries and put them in the top of a mason jar lid and sprinkle sugar over them and let them sit in the sun and then turn them over, and those would be our pies. So we did all kinds of crazy things. We caught June bugs. A June bug is a Japanese beetle. We didn't know what they were called back then. We just called them June bugs, I think, because they came around in June. I don't know. But we catch a June bug and tie a string around one of its legs, and then when it took off, it would be like, you know, our little flying June bug on a string. All kinds of crazy stuff as kids. But, you know, we were always outside, so we were doing a lot of things that involved nature. We would build houses out of cardboard boxes. I just remember a lot of outdoor things. Playing hide and go seek, red light, those kinds of things. I was a smart child. I really liked school, and I did well in school. I liked reading in particular. I never missed a day of school if I could help it. Even if I was sick, I would beg my mother to send me to school. So I got lots of certificates for perfect attendance that I still have today, that my mother kept all these years. I didn't know that we were poor. Didn't really realize that until I got to high school and met really rich kids and went to their homes, and then I was like, oh, we don't have the kinds of things that they have. But until then, I didn't want for anything. And my mother is a baker, and that's how I learned to cook. I love to bake, and she was known as the cake lady, and red velvet cake is her favorite. And sweet potato pie. And I spent a lot of time with my mom because I'm the baby. Many times my brothers didn't want me hanging around with them, so I spent time with my mom and my sister. So I got to hear all the gossip going on in the community and learn how to do a lot of stuff like cook, which I enjoyed. So it was a very happy childhood, I have to say.
I love the blueberry pie. That's so inventive. Oh my gosh. Backtracking a little, you mentioned that your mom put you in like performances and like started singing. Can you tell me about like what your early experiences were like as a performer?
Yeah, I started singing like at the age of 5 in the church choir, the children's choir. I was a soprano, and I remained a soprano until the 8th or 9th grade. Is when my voice started to, it was longer than that. It was 10th grade, because remember, it wasn't until I was like 15 that my voice started to change. But until then, I sang soprano and would out sing all the girls in the choir. I was only a boy in the soprano section. My mother put me in a lot of talent shows at the community center, as I was saying earlier. Ridgeview Community Center was in the black neighborhood, and they were always having talent shows. And so mom would put me in these talent shows, and half the time I'd run off stage because I was too shy. And then when we got home, you know, I would perform, but yeah, it was just. And I was in a lot of things at church. Church was really the place where I performed the most, especially singing in the children's choir and being in church plays and Easter speeches and Christmas speeches, those kinds of things. And then there was a teacher, my first grade teacher, Mrs. Bunny White. Mm-hmm. She really saw something in me when I was in her class, and I was in the first integrated class, and this was 1973, so even though Brown versus the Board of Education had become law in 1954, schools weren't fully integrated until 1973, and so Mrs. White's first grade class was the first year of integration for a lot of schools in Hickory. So she was young and idealistic and really saw something in me. And so she became my patron. She paid for my first piano lessons, which I hated piano lessons because Mrs. McFarlane was her name. Every time I hit a wrong key, she would pop my hand with the ruler. So I stopped taking piano lessons. I wish I had not stopped. That's my one regret, that I continued to take piano lessons. But Mrs. White paid for my first piano lessons. She also had me be in a play at her church, which was a Lutheran church, Corinth Lutheran Church. And I didn't belong to her church. I mean, this was a very large, white, prestigious church. But they had a church play about the prodigal son called Barbecue for Ben, which was a musical. And I played the prodigal son. And it's so funny. I still remember some of those songs from that show. And I was like 7 or 8, you know. But I was a star of Barbecue for Ben. And I also auditioned for a television show called Palmerstown, USA. It was very short-lived, and I didn't get cast. But I did audition for that television show in Charlotte. And I was just in a lot of stuff, talent shows, musicals, those kinds of things. And in high school, I was in the drama club and I was in plays. I played everything from Mount Joy in the Mouse That Roared to Framji in Around the World in 80 Days. Can't remember the character I played in Invisible Man. I was also in Tartuffe. I mean, it was in, you know, a lot of, you know, plays in high school. And so it was a combination of community plays and events, school, and church. But I was always in something.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, how old were you at the barbecue, Ben?
Like 7 or 8.
7 or 8?
Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
It was so much fun.
Yeah.
Mrs. White would come and pick me up every day, take me to rehearsal. And I just loved it because I got to sing. And I had never been in, you know, anything like that. All the plays. And in fact, that might have been the first play I'd ever been in because I was, I hadn't been in any church plays at that point. So I loved it. And again, I was the only black person in the play and I was a star. So it was a lot of fun. I remember one of the songs was, "Nan, Nan, Johnny's jealous, Johnny's mad, and he can't catch me." I don't know why that one comes to mind. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Great. So moving forward a little bit, how did you come to attend UNC Chapel Hill?
I didn't apply to any other school. And that, looking back, that was probably not a wise thing, because, you know, I may not have gotten in, but I just always knew that I would come to UNC Chapel Hill, not because anyone in my family had gone here. My other brothers who had gone to college, one went to the Laura Ryan College, and one went to North Carolina Central, but I just wanted to come to UNC. I don't even really know why. I just knew I wanted to come here. And so it was literally the only university that I applied to. And my guidance counselor was not happy about that. And she had encouraged me to apply to other schools because she said, "You may not get in." And I said, "Well, no, that's the only place I want to go." And I got in. And I got a scholarship from the Hickory Junior League, which is this very rich, you know, white women's group. But I got a $4,000 scholarship from them. And I was a finalist for the, oh, it's not the Moorhead. It was this other scholarship that they have here that I was a finalist for, but I didn't get it. But anyway, it didn't matter. I got in, and I lived in Hinton James, first in room 543 my freshman year, and then in room 555 my sophomore year. And then I moved off campus to Carrboro, to Tar Heel Manor, and lived there for my junior and senior year. I was very active. I sang in the, it was then called the BSM Gospel Choir, now it's called the UNC Gospel Choir. I was an Opeo, not an Opeo dancer, I was an Ebony Reader, and I think they're still around. I was involved in the BSM in general, part of marches and protests to get a freestanding Black Cultural Center, which we now have, which I never thought that would happen. I was involved in lots of performances, particularly in speech communication, which it was then called oral interpretation, now it's called performance studies. I was in a lot of shows. I loved to perform. I also directed my own shows of my own work, my own poetry. I did a show called Never Had a Crossword, which was Never a Dull Moment, which was a performance based on my own poetry. It was a big ensemble cast. I adapted James Baldwin's Go Tell on the Mountain for the stage. I did a performance called Black Diaspora Love, which took place in the Union, which was an adaptation of Black Love poems. It was a cast of six of us, I think. I just love performing, and you know, being here was a great place to make that happen. It was also here that I became exposed to oral history. My first performance of an oral history was in a class that Della Pollock taught on oral history, and it was the book that we used was Like a Family by Jacqueline Hall and Jim Lalutis, and the class adapted those oral histories for performance, and then we toured around the state. We went back to some of the cotton mill towns and performed the stories for those communities. So that was really exciting, and that really got me interested in oral history and performance. And so I ended up writing my MA thesis on my grandmother's oral history, and my dissertation was also on my grandmother's oral history.
Great. So moving back, I want to hear more about the Black Student Movement Gospel Choir.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell me more about, like, what kind of people were in it? Were they just the experience?
Yeah, well, I became exposed to the BSM Gospel Choir 2 years before I even got here, because one of my best friends who came to Carolina directed the choir. And so the choir came to my church when I was still in high school. And so I was exposed to them before I even arrived here. And so there was no question that, you know, as to whether I would join the choir or not. So I auditioned first semester of my freshman year, and I sang in the choir all 4 years. I became president of a choir in my junior year. In my junior year, I was co-president. In my senior year, I was president by myself. And then when I became a graduate student, I continued to direct and sing with them. And it was, that was like my family, because it was other folks who were church kids, you know, who sang in the choir back home. And the choir was our church, but it had a whole host of people in it. I mean, at its smallest, I think it was around 40, and at its biggest, it was close to 100. And we traveled. We traveled all around the state. We would get invited to go to different churches. Some of the churches that we went to were the churches of the choir members. Like, we went back to my church in Hickory, Morning Star First Baptist Church. They had come before I got here, and then, of course, when I was here, we went back there. But we traveled all around the state. We also entered choir competitions. I don't know if they still have it or not, but there used to be a McDonald's Gospel Fest, and we entered McDonald's Gospel Fest for 2 years in a row, and we placed third in one of them. It was just amazing. I loved singing with the BSM choir. And we had we'd have a fall concert and a spring concert on campus. And I still have some of those on videotape, actually. And, you know, our parents would come down to the concert. Sometimes we'd invite guest choirs. There was so much pride in the choir. I remember we created t-shirts just about every year. One was with a Snoopy with a choir robe on it. I still have some of those t-shirts, actually. But it was a real sense of community in the choir. And some of the people that I met in the choir, you know, I'm still friends with. and will be friends with them for the rest of my life. It was just a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. One of the other interns just did an interview with Randall Keenan,
mm-hmm.
And he had mentioned this choir also being, like, really important. Did your times intersect at all, or?
Randall graduated the year I came.
Okay.
So he graduated in the spring of 85, and I entered in the fall of 85. So our time didn't overlap, but there were people who just hung around after they graduated mm-hmm. and continued to sing in the choir. So I sang in the choir with people from Randall Keenan's generation, Anthony Bullock being one of those people. These were people who would have arrived in Chapel Hill like in 80 and 81. So they just loved the choir so much that even though they graduated, they continued to sing. And a lot of the musicians continued to play for the choir even after they graduated. It was just that kind of family.
Absolutely. And with the poetry
mm-hmm.
that you wrote and were performing, what kind of stuff did you write about?
When I look back at it now, some of it was really bad, like really, really bad. But I wrote about my life a lot. You know, I wrote about being poor. I remember one of the poems that I wrote was called Black Christmas. And it starts out, no lights, no gifts. Just another Black Christmas. I wrote about love and relationships, or the lack thereof. I wrote sort of militant poems. I was really enamored with the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s. And so I wrote poems in that style, you know, sort of militant poems. I wrote some suicide poems, and you know, looking back now, it was a lot because I was struggling with being gay and running away from it, so some of the poems were about that, even though I was saying, oh no, it's just a poem, it's not about me. I wrote poems about my mother. In fact, I have a poem called Motherhood that's about my mother. I have a poem about my grandmother. I wrote poems about my teachers, my mentors. I wrote poems about friends of mine who were close. So those were the things. A lot of my poetry was really personal, autobiographical. And if they weren't, they were about things that I had witnessed, like homelessness, or just commentary on daily life.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about the sexuality piece, what was your coming out process like internally and then to the outside world?
Yeah, well, when I was here at UNC, there was no coming out mm-hmm. process. I had lots of friends who were gay, who were open. And I knew, I think, that I was gay, but wasn't ready to come to terms with that. And so I had a girlfriend. When did we start dating? I think it was my junior year. And we lived together for a little while. And I truly cared for her, but I always knew that there was something that I hadn't come to terms with. And so I wanted to run away from that. So I didn't really come out, per se, until I moved from North Carolina, until I moved to Baton Rouge
mm-hmm.
to graduate school. And interestingly enough, there were a lot of gay people in my graduate cohort. So on the one hand, it was more comfortable for me to come out in that space because I wasn't home, you know, wasn't around in home territory, but also because there were so many other gay people in the program. At the same time, the racism I experienced in Baton Rouge, which is really intense. So that was interesting to me, that on the one hand, being gay was cool, but being black wasn't. So when I was at UNC, some of the poems that I wrote had a lot to do with thoughts of suicide, depression, and all that, because I knew that I was gay, but didn't want to deal with it. It wasn't until, you know, I moved away. And that's when I really had my first boyfriend, is when I, my first year of my PhD program at LSU. And it was someone that was in graduate school here at UNC, who I had known as an undergraduate, and then he went to LSU, and then I went to LSU, and we started dating. That was my first boyfriend.
And the friends you referenced, having friends you knew were gay while you were at Carolina?
Yes, I did have lots of friends who I knew were gay.
Were they black, white?
Mostly black. Yeah, most of my friends who were gay were black. I knew a couple of white gay people, but mostly black. Yeah, they were mostly black, and mostly in the choir.
Yeah. How did you, what were your friendships with them like?
They were very close. It's interesting. I was proclaiming to be heterosexual, but I was never ashamed of my gay friends. I hung out with them. I knew they were gay, and so there wasn't, I wasn't one of those closeted gay people who didn't hang around other gay people because I didn't want to be guilty by association. That wasn't my MO. Mine was, well, I'm straight, but I'm cool and I have gay friends. Even though everybody knew that I was also gay, except for me. So I had a lot of gay friends, and we hung out together. We, you know, we sang, we shopped, we went to movies, I love to cook, as I said, and so I cooked a lot in the dorm, even in Hinton James. So people would come over and, you know, I'd make lasagna, I would, you know, cook these big meals in the dorm room, we'd come and we'd eat, so. Yeah, I had lots of gay friends, lots.
Did you have any impressions of, or interactions with kind of what I'm coming to understand, more mainstream white gay groups on campus, maybe Carolina Gay Association, Lambda Magazine?
No, the CGLA is what it was called back then. I don't know if it's still called that now. But they were so stigmatized on campus when I was here, and this was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
That they had their meetings in secret. I remember on National Coming Out Day, it would be Blue Jeans Day, so no one would wear blue jeans because they didn't want to be associated with, you know, the CGLA. So no, I had no association with the mainstream gay organization on campus, or I didn't know there was a newspaper. That was just not in my orbit. My gay friends were within the choir, and my activism was around the black student movement. I later found out that my freshman year roommate was gay. He was white, but at the time he wasn't out and he had a girlfriend too. So, I didn't know a lot of gay white people. No, not at all.
Could you talk more about your activism with Black Student Movement? I know that was really exciting, mobilizing to get an independent space. Why was that important?
Well, because at the time, Black Cultural Center was a room in the student union. And it just seemed to us that Black students were an integral part of campus, and that BSM was huge and such a force. And we didn't have a space. there was just not a space, and trying to do programming and all of that kind of thing, and it was just very important to us. Also because there weren't a lot of Black students on campus, and yet we were being exploited in sports, with the basketball team and the football team. And the other thing is, North Carolina State had their own Black Cultural Center, and we thought it was odd that the flagship institution would not. Every year there was always some march or protest in the pit to try to demand a free space. And things didn't really heat up until after I left. I think it was after Professor Sonia Stone died, that's when things really got heated, because she was one of the people that was also behind a free space. And so the students just, around when she died, the students just really galvanized around that and really pressured the administration to do something. So I missed that part because I left here in 91. I graduated from undergrad in 89 and then did my MA between 89 and 91, and then I left. And then I think it was in 93, thereabouts, that Sonia Stone died. And it was like, that's what really pushed things to the edge. But some of the other things I was active in was the anti-apartheid movement. We had shanties on, not in the pit, but in the quad between Wilson and South Building. And I'll never forget, there was this guy named, it's not Inko, what was his name? I can't remember, he chained himself to South Building. There was a lot of stuff going on back then, but it was all to try to get the university to divest in protest of what was going on in South Africa. So I was involved in that. I was involved in getting more African American Studies classes on the books, because we had African American Studies department, but there weren't a lot, and there weren't a whole lot of faculty in the department. So, BSM was instrumental in, protesting. We were always protesting about something. Those were interesting times back then.
What role did you usually play in these protests and organizing?
I didn't really have a leadership role in them. I was just one of the many students who would march, who would just participate. But I didn't hold any leadership positions in the umbrella group of BSM. I was just president of the choir. And so as president of the choir, I got to be a part of the, all of the subgroups that the presidents of the subgroups would have meet a larger meeting with the president of BSM and the other leaders. But I didn't play a leadership role in those protests and marches. I was just a member of, the collective, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever, you spoke about your poetry being sometimes militant, mm-hmm. did you ever use your performance as with an activist bent, or?
Not here, mm-hmm. no, I'm not, no, not at UNC, no, no.
Okay. I guess moving forward now a little bit, I want to hear about your experience doing the oral history of your grandmother, mm-hmm. you said, and, like, what was that like?
Well, I didn't know that conducting an oral history could be considered scholarship, but I would tell stories about my grandmother all the time because she was quite a character, and I was originally going to do my MA thesis on, it's convoluted, I was going to adapt this Richard Wright short story called Big Black Good Man for the stage, and then do a pre-test, post-test. I was going to try to measure the level of interracial communication apprehension before audience saw the show and after audience saw the show. It's crazy. And my mentor, D. Soyini Madison at the time, said, why don't you do a thesis on your grandmother? I was like, I can write about my grandmother? She's like, yes, you can. And I said, I would love to do that. So I ended up going back and staying with my grandmother over the summer and interviewing her about, during that time, about her life living in this little senior citizen community. She lived in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. And my grandmother was sort of like there were two rows of these apartments, and my grandmother was in the center, which was so appropriate because she was always in the center of everything. And so those stories were about her neighbors, who were characters themselves. You know, this woman that lived beside her who thought she saw snakes. So she would ball up aluminum foil and put them in these imaginary holes in her apartment to keep the snakes out. So they called her the Snake Woman. To another neighbor named David, who my grandmother swore was gay because he baked pies. So I had so much fun, you know, collecting those oral histories from my grandmother. Then when I went to LSU, I knew that I would continue the work with my grandmother, but I wanted to focus on her life as a domestic worker, because mm-hmm. my grandmother was a live-in domestic for 18 years. And I wanted to sort of talk to her about what her life was like living in white people's homes and being a maid for 18 years. And so I spent another summer with her, interviewing her every other day about her life as a domestic worker. And I also interviewed her employer, her former employer, and that was very interesting. My grandmother attended that interview. She was with me. And her former employer referred to her as a mammy. She said, I asked her, how did my grandmother come to work for you? And she said, I was looking for a real good mammy. So that was very confronting to, you know, listen to someone refer to my grandmother as a mammy. So my grandmother left their employment under very sort of mysterious circumstances. And I never had heard I'd never gotten the full story of why she stopped working for this family. And my grandmother told them and told me that she stopped working for them because her brother in Washington, D.C., got sick and she had to go take care of him. And that didn't wash with me because I knew the brother that she was talking about, and he had family, had children, so I knew that it was something. And I, growing up, I never remembered my grandmother moving to Washington, D.C. And so it turns out that right around the time that she was supposedly moving to D.C. to take care of her sick brother was the same time that her employer's oldest daughter was getting married. And they wanted my grandmother to attend the wedding and sit next to her mother. And the real story is that my grandmother didn't want to go to the wedding because she didn't want to be put on display. And so she made up this story about the sick brother. And so she wasn't in D.C. She was in Kings Mountain. She moved to Kings Mountain and got a factory job. But until her former employer died, she believed that my grandmother didn't come back to work because she had a sick brother. So it was interesting interviewing my grandmother and also interviewing her employer, because I had to put aside my own feelings about their relationship and sort of appreciate their relationship as a black woman and a white woman of a particular generation, and how that generation interacted across racial lines. Because they remained friends even after my grandmother stopped working for her, but sometimes she would ask my grandmother to work for her, do light cleaning, even when my grandmother was just supposed to be visiting. But you know, it was a complicated relationship. But I ended up adapting my grandmother's oral history to a stage play called Never Had a Crossword, because that was one of my grandmother's sayings about the family. Never had a crossword with them, meaning she never had an argument with them or never had anything bad to say about them. So I wrote a play based on her narrative that I did at Northwestern about a decade ago.
What did your grandmother think about being part of this project?
Oh, she didn't know quite what it was for. She knew that it was going to help me in my schooling. And like I said, my grandmother was a great storyteller. So she enjoyed talking, but I think more importantly, she enjoyed having me around because I was, you know, I lived with her, and she always loved cooking, so she would cook for me, and you know, so, and I had a great time because she was hysterical, just really funny and ornery person. So, she really didn't know what a dissertation was. She just said, well, if this is going to help you, then, you know, I'll do it. And my grandmother got on a plane for the first time to fly to Louisiana to watch me graduate. So that was really special that she was at my graduation.
Is she a maternal grandmother?
Yes, she's yes. My mother's mother.
Yeah. And you mentioned that your mother also was a domestic worker, mm-hmm. and that you would sometimes visit and like go to work with her. What was that like?
Well, with my mom, I don't remember a lot because I was really mm-hmm. young, like 5. It was before I went to kindergarten. I just remember the things in the Olsen's house were very nice. You know, it was a very nice house. And I also remember my mother wouldn't allow me to touch things. You know, I couldn't, you know, touch the things in her house. And I remember there were times when Mrs. Olsen would take me for ice cream. But I was really young, and one of the more traumatizing things I remember is my mother being scratched up by their cat. I don't know what happened, but my mother, maybe the cat was on the counter or something, she was trying to shoo it off, and it just really scratched her up bad. I don't remember a lot about going to the Olsons with my mom, because I was really young. And then I think by the time I got to first grade, my mother started working in a factory. Because Hickory is known for furniture, and so there are lots of furniture companies there. Hickory Springs was the one that my mother worked for, and she worked in the part of Hickory Springs that made the foam for mattresses and sofas and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you've been talking a lot about food. I was just wondering if you could tell me how that got to be so important for you.
Well, in the South, so much happens around food. Mm-hmm. And so Sunday dinner was always a big thing, because we would eat well on Sunday. And it was, you know, some variation of chicken. Barbecue chicken, fried chicken, boiled chicken, chicken and dumplings. Sometimes we would have ham, especially around Easter time. And lots of vegetables cooked with pork. and cooked for a long time. But breaking bread, eating, was just an important thing that the community did, that the family did, that the church did. You know, sometimes we'd eat after church in fellowship hall. And it's so funny, because my mother was really, and my aunt Marley in particular, were really interesting about food in public. And what I mean by that is, if there was a potluck or something like that, there are certain things that they would not eat that other people prepared, like chitlins. They would say, well, you don't eat everybody's chitlins because you don't know if they clean them. Well, it all has pig shit going for it, so, I mean. But they wouldn't eat everybody's chitlins. They wouldn't eat everybody's potato salad, you know, because everyone has their own way of making things. So that was always funny to me. And I have friends now who are still that way. They won't eat everybody's, and you just fill in the blank. So that's just, you know, a side note about food that's really funny to me. And some people were known for making really good cakes, and other people were known for making really bad cakes. So my mother was a really good baker, and everybody loved eating her food, especially her red velvet cakes. And, you know, she's 83 now and still is baking, you know, cakes and pies. People put in orders at Christmas time for her to, you know, bake cakes and things like that. But food was just a part of everything. And what's interesting to me was the way people made food. Like, I still can't make biscuits the way my mom can make biscuits. My biscuits turn out like hockey pucks. and she makes it look so easy, but it's not. But everybody had, you know, their own way of preparing food, in particular certain dishes. Eating was something that you didn't take for granted. Because there were people who, you know, didn't have food to eat. And so the adults were always invested in you getting enough to eat. Even when I go home now, my mother's like, have you had anything to eat? Because, you know, she wants to cook for me. So eating is just, and food, is a very important part of our community and part of growing up.
What, it seems like you have a lot of like influential women in your life, is that correct?
Yeah.
What has it been like working on your newest project, which is about like women who love women that are Black in the South?
It's been a wonderful experience working on Honeypot. The women's stories are different from the men's in some significant ways, especially around sexual violence. I've interviewed 70 women and 55 of them have experienced some kind of sexual trauma, and mostly at the hands of a male relative, which has been really fascinating. The women are not as performative in the telling of their stories. The men were like just all over the place and, you know, really invested in the performance of the story. Whereas the women, there are some exceptions, but most of the women were kind of matter of fact, you know, just, you know, it was like a conversation. And I thought that was fascinating. A lot of the women had relationships with men, healthy relationships with men. Some of them have children. Many of them have been married. And so I find that their sexuality was much more fluid than the men's. There weren't a lot of what they call gold star lesbians. bronze and silver, but not gold star. I thought that was interesting. So one of the things that a lot of people asked me was, you know, how did you as a man get women to open up to you? And because a lot of people didn't think that women would talk to me because I'm a man. And that wasn't the case at all. I think that I have a fairly disarming personality, and so people felt comfortable. I also think because they knew about Sweet Tea,
mm-hmm.
that they were, you know, willing to participate. And then one woman told me that she was comfortable with telling me her story, because if I had been a woman, she feels that a woman would have judged her because of some of the things that she shared, like having an abortion. I didn't have any trouble getting women to share their stories with me and share intimate stories with me. And it's been a different experience than with the men because of the gender difference, but because the themes that they discuss are a little different based on gender. You know, a lot of the women say that it was fine for them to be a tomboy as a little girl because they, you know, some of them grew up in the country, and so, you know, being a tomboy was no problem. But being a sissy was always a problem. So they talk about how little boys that they knew who were effeminate got beat up a lot or got chastised in ways that they didn't for being tomboys.
Was that your experience as a child at all?
I was picked on and teased a little, but because I was fat. I was a fat kid. I wore a size called Husky. I don't know if they make that now. But I was fat, and I had a high voice, and I had a big butt, and I had a lisp. So, you know, I was primed to be a target of bullying. But I didn't get bullied that much, mainly because I became a class clown. I could imitate people very well, and so I started imitating my teachers. This was in, they still called it junior high then, it's called middle school now. But I would, in order to make friends, I would imitate the teachers when they left the room. And so I didn't get picked on a lot. And I also didn't know a lot of other gay people. And there were other boys who were effeminate, who were my age, one in particular. But he was very athletic. He turned out to be gay. I don't think everybody knew, but because he was athletic, he didn't get teased. And I knew a couple of tomboys who ended up being lesbians, one of whom I interviewed for Honey Pot. But there wasn't, I don't know, I didn't experience a lot of bullying when I was a kid. I did get called sissy and sometimes faggot, but not really to my face. I think Hickory was different from a lot of towns in that regard because my church wasn't homophobic growing up. That may have something to do with the preacher's son being gay, but he's not out to them even now. But he never preached a homophobic sermon. I never experienced that in church. I never really experienced any kind of, like, the bullying that goes on today, you know, where kids are getting, you know, beat up and that kind of, I didn't experience that at all.
As a child, did you ever have any awareness that there were older men who, like, lived with other men or liked other men or women?
No, I didn't grow up knowing other men who lived with other men. When I was a tween, we knew men who were effeminate because they were like really flamboyant and people would talk about them. But they didn't live with other people. And people really didn't bother them because they could defend themselves. So you might hear someone catcall at them or something, but physically harm them, because they would fight back. But I didn't know, and still to this day, I haven't even heard of couples living together in Hickory, men or women. I remember there was this one woman who people thought was lesbian, and my uncle, who was a dirty old man, used to take Polaroid pictures of all kinds of women at the barbershop. He used to hang out at the barbershop, and there was a salon that was attached to the barbershop, and so the women were up there, and my Uncle Johnny would be up there taking Polaroid pictures of all these women and flirting and stuff, so my mother asked him to bring over some of his pictures, not of women, but so she wanted to go through his pictures to see if he had any of our previous family reunions, because she wanted to make a collage of those pictures. So my Uncle Johnny didn't go through the pictures in advance. He just brought all of the pictures he had, and they were in two trash bags. And he brought them to my mother's house and dumped them on the table. Though my mother and my sister and my Aunt Marlee and we're all, you know, sitting around the table going through these pictures, and all these pictures of women, some naked women. I mean, it was, so one of the pictures was this picture of a woman named Sylvia, who people in the neighborhood thought was a lesbian. And so my Aunt Marlee says, "Isn't this a picture of Sylvia?" And my Uncle Johnny gets this wry smile on his face and says, "Yeah, that's it." He would short her name to Sip. And my Aunt Marlee said, "Well, isn't she half and half? And he said, yeah, she half and half. And she said, well, what are you doing with her? And he said, I was with a half I could be with. So, yeah, my Uncle Johnny was really a dirty old man. So, she was about the only woman that was even rumored to be gay. There were several flamboyant men in the neighborhood, but no one bothered them.
Are there any other questions? Is there anything else that you thought I would ask about and I didn't? Or that you want to talk about?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm great.
And is this for the big LGBT oral history project that Hunter is doing?
Yeah, it's like more broadly on the, let me turn this off.